Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 42, titled Exchanging Oneself for Others.
Now we come to Shantideva's method. Because a lot of it is devoted to what's called the meditation of ugliness. And a lot of it really seems to assault the female embodiment in particular, for which, you know, Buddhists should apologize. And it's only because he's writing in a male monastery. And basically the meditation on offensiveness or unloveliness, which is offensive and unlovely, is precisely supposed to be, is meant to de-glamorize sexual longing, sexual attraction, and so forth. And actually it works rather well. I remember once when I taught with a lama in a Zen center in California, like 30 years ago, I was translating for Swama, and we translated this kind of thing. And people were really freaked out about it. The Zen people were, you know, they're in California, you know, they call themselves Zen monks and nuns, but actually they all have girlfriends and boyfriends because they're confused about Japanese history. And they're not monks and nuns, but they are yogis, meditators. And they got very upset. But then everyone was amused because they had a beach party on the night of that particular seminar, on the Saturday night. And then one woman who was sang folk songs, she sang this great song about how, you know, I was like doing this and that, you know, and then I went to see my honey, but then I met Shantideva, and then Shantideva, and then suddenly I realized that my honey was a shit machine. In other words, you put in food and out comes excrement, you know, like looking at the intestines and what's in the body and nature of the body, you know, and you get, it deglamorizes, let's say, it really strongly deglamorizes, which is very good for when someone's horny. And in monasteries, that's a very necessary thing. And the nuns' literature has it. Unfortunately, there were less nuns and less writings from the nuns. So there's, you know, in trying to ward off the accusation of male chauvinism, which you can't completely ward off in any history of any tradition, including Buddhism, because that's been the history of the last several thousand militarized years on this planet, you'd like to point to an equal body of literature vilifying and, you know, looking at the offensiveness of the male body, but it's just less. There's less of it, but there is. It's there, and also you're supposed to see your own body that way. That's why you meditate on your own body as a corpse. But that's considered an advance. You don't want to do that, or you'll get depressed. You know, you think of your own body as lying in front of you as dead and decaying, and over second day, third day, like how it looked. You've only seen corpses probably all dolled up in tuxedos with like rouge and embalmed, you know, probably never seen a real one. But it's quite shocking what happens to the body very, very quickly when the blood ceases to circulate. So, but anyway, that's just there. And that's in the meditation chapter because when people meditate, they get down to their instincts. And that's a way of turning down the normal sort of lust instinct and beginning to gain control over that and then to sublimate that into new kinds of experiences, meditative experiences and so on, consciously. So that's what that's there for. But anyways, that's why the compassion part in the meditation chapter only begins on verse 90. Okay? Then he makes his argument. The hand and other limbs are many and distinct, but all are one, the body to be kept and guarded. Likewise, different beings in their joys and sorrows are like me, all one in wanting happiness. So here he's proposing that we think of other beings' bodies and other beings' sensations and other beings' experiences as equal to ours, and we don't want them to be painful, and we do want them to be pleasant, just like we do that to ourselves as a natural thing. This pain of he acknowledges here, and Shantideva always writes, as you've noted by now from reading it, he writes with his normal egocentric mind debating with his sort of bodhisattva mind and sort of looking at objections and things. So here he doesn't actually have one expressed, but he anticipates one. He says, this pain of mine does not afflict or cause discomfort to another's body. And yet this pain is hard for me to bear because I cling and take it for my own. And here he's referring to what we normally don't think. Like what we think, like if I touch a sharp point, then it makes a little pain, which transmits up my nerves and it's interpreted as pain, and I don't want to do that. But there are very many conditions, and you can be hypnotized where, you know, people stick a pin, you don't feel it. You've been hypnotized to turn off identifying that sensation as being painful. And this can be done, and then it can happen normally, like when you're playing in a team or something and you get kicked, but you're just about to score a goal and you're very heated up and excited. You sort of don't notice the pain of the kick, you know, the pain of being hit or kicked until you calm down later. And this happens in war. People don't notice a bullet going through a muscle or something when they're in the middle of shooting others. And it happens in any kind of, you know, exceptional experience. Pain does not notice. And pain requires a mental, appropriation of the pain along with the physical sensation. And other beings' pains I do not feel, and yet, because I take them for myself, this suffering, their suffering is mine and therefore hard to bear. So in other words, one can identify with the pain of another. And where was I recently? I was actually discussing this in a seminar situation somewhere. And then somebody stumbled and fell, and there was a loud noise. And everybody in the room like went, ah, like this. You know? So that's the type of thing, you know, where you identify with another's thing. And of course, they didn't feel the stubbed toe or whatever the person who hurt themselves did quite to the same degree. But we do have the ability to identify with the pain of others to a much greater degree, actually, is what Shantideva is arguing here. Since I and other beings, both in wanting happiness, are equal and alike, what difference is there to distinguish us that I should strive to have my happiness alone, he says. Which is what we normally do, and we ignore other beings' condition. But he's saying really that's not reasonable, because they all want the happiness too. And they are just as sensitive as me, and I could be identifying with their happiness if they were my child or something very, or my beloved or something. I would then feel their pain almost as I do my own. Since I and other beings, both in fleeing suffering, are equal and alike, what difference is there to distinguish us that I should save myself and not the others? Now, then he anticipates the argument of another person of his other mind that says, well, since the pain of others does no harm to me, then I don't shield myself. Or why should I shield myself from it? Why should I bother with theirs? But then Shantideva answers very cleverly, so why to guard against my future pain, which does no harm to this, my present me? That's a good translation, by the way, that particular verse. I like the one they did that. In other words, we do very much guard against future pain, even though we don't feel it. So there, it's only kind of like an inferential or intellectual matter of that pain that we fear, that we could have in the future if we do such and such and such and such. And we strongly identify with not having it, because we do identify with what we imagine to be our future condition when we will suffer it. So therefore, we can guard against something that we don't feel in the same way as we feel our immediate pain. That's a very good counter-argument. To think that I will have to bear it if this such and such happens is in fact a false idea. For that which dies is one thing, what is born is something else. And here some of the people who are against future life, they use this as an argument that Shantideva doesn't think about any such thing himself, which is false. It just means that that which is over, which finishes, is one thing, and then the next, then you change it every minute. So therefore, you don't know that you're going to have to bear it. When you imagine a future pain, you don't know if you really will have it. Like, if I walk over there and fall down, I will have such and such a pain, so I fear to walk over there. But you might not fall down. So in fact, it's a false idea. It's all that he's saying. He's not saying that there's no continuity between what dies and what is born in normal rebirth setting. It's for the sufferers themselves, you'll say, to shield themselves from injuries that come. It's almost, I translated that, for the one who dies here is almost totally different from the one reborn. So then they are saying future pain. They are projecting it to future life in the previous verse. So that's not completely wrong. But it doesn't mean, it's just, the almost word is in there in the Sanskrit. And they are ignoring it in this translation because of being infected by certain people. Anyway, never mind. It's for the sufferers themselves, you'll say, to shield themselves from injuries that come. That's their problem. Well, then, he said, he answers, the pain felt in my foot is not my hands. So why, in fact, should my hand protect my foot? That's a good one. True, it's inadmissible, you'll say. It happens simply through the force of ego clinging. But what is inadmissible for others and myself should be discarded utterly, is his answer. So the arguer is just saying, why are you ego clinging about some other person? And he says, well, you admit then it's inadmissible, pain and suffering in general. So it should be both for me and others, it should be inadmissible. And then he says, continue and gathering so-called like garlands and like armies, you know, garlands of flowers, and armies of individual soldiers are unreal. The general thing is less real than the individual thing. So there is no one to experience pain, for who is there to be its owner? So this is kind of an argument against him. So he's trying to use the selflessness idea against worrying about having to worry about others' pain. And then suffering has no possessor, therefore no distinctions can be made in it. Since pain, it is to be dispelled. What use is there in drawing boundaries? Shantideva answers. So it's not reasonable to say that others' pain is less important than your pain. But why? And in fact, once you practice exchange of self and other, others, so there are many more others than you. So there's a lot more pain when many others are painful. Well, he'll come to that argument actually. But why dispel the pains of all? His mind argues against him. And then he says, you cannot argue in this way to his mind. If my pain is removed, so too should that of others. If theirs is not, then neither should be mine. Neither should mine be, I would want to say anyway. Compassion makes us feel such pain, you say, so why should we make efforts to engender it? And here's the one of saying, well, why should I empathize with others feeling pain, since compassion is no good, the empathy part of it, because it just increases the amount of pain that we feel. That's terrible. So why should we try to increase our pain? That's terrible. And then Shantideva first sort of challenges him morally and says, himself morally, but says, but thinking of the sufferings of beings, which are so huge, how can you regard as great the smart of your compassion? The sting of your compassion. I don't know, smart. Sting of your compassion. And if through such a single pain, a multitude of sorrows can be cured, such pain as this, all loving people strive to foster in themselves and others. So in other words, this little bit of altruism whereby I'm going to suffer a little bit, then my children will be happier, you know. I will suffer a little bit, then my community will be happier. You know, everyone is willing to put up with something in the idea that, I mean, it's considered heroism, it's considered virtue, it's considered even morally necessary that people are willing to undergo some sort of difficulties in order to help lots of others. It's a normal thing in human beings, actually. It's the essence of the successfulness, actually, of human beings as a species. Some will argue, I think, successfully. Thus, Supushpa Chandra, he refers, knowing that the king would cause him harm, did nothing to escape from tribulation. This is a famous heroic story. They give you a footnote. I don't even remember what it is myself. That the pains of many should be ended. Those whose minds are practiced in this way, whose joy it is to soothe another ills, will venture into the hell of unrelenting pain as swans sweep down upon a lotus lake. And here, he's not really... Oh yeah, the ocean-like immensity of joy arising when all beings will be freed, will this not be enough? Which means that's Buddhahood. Will this not satisfy? The wish for my own freedom alone, what is that to me? So here his answer really is just simply resorting to the definition of a Buddha, which is not generally successful, really, if someone doesn't know what a Buddha might be. that a Buddhahood is said to be a state of being where one not only feels completely free of any kind of pain or unpleasantness, complete blissful, one recognizes that one is made of bliss actually, and that reality is bliss, and one sees all other beings as in bliss actually, and even one sees that the future moments when others themselves will see that they are in bliss is immediate to you as a Buddha, so you don't feel impatient in working to help them come to that understanding. So in other words, you don't break your bodhisattva vow, because the future moment when the being that you eventually will teach, or you can help discover for themselves the true nature of reality that you have seen to be bliss, the moment in the future when they will come to that optimally as helped by you most energetically, is such that you don't feel that you're leaving them behind. You realize that they need that time to come to that understanding, and that help to come to that understanding themselves. And that future moment when they do is optimal as far as you're concerned. And it's present to you, although not to them. You realize it isn't to them. So anyway, So that's answering is meaningful to someone who knows that definition and not meaningful to another. So in a way, I remember I always used to tell people I was very dissatisfied with these two verses, the swan upon the lotus lake, because it doesn't really answer the question, why should I feel that suffering, because people don't necessarily believe that. But in a way, he answers it in the next chapter, the wisdom chapter, which we'll discuss on Thursday, because it requires wisdom. So he just appeals to a definition. To his fellow Buddhists in this case. The work of bringing benefit to beings. It reminds me of a story. The Dalai Lama tells a story about, he met a saint in Spain, a yogi monk, who had been in solitude for many years, and for some reason, I think it was at Lourdes or one of those kind of pilgrimage places, he was traveling and he wanted to go see the Virgin there, so he went there. He met this saint. People arranged for the saint, I guess, wanted to meet him. And then he asked that saint, who was not very talkative because he'd been by himself for like 10 years or some long period of time. So he asked him, he said, "But what have you been meditating on?" And he said, the saint looked up and looked at him and said, "Oh, I've been meditating on love." And then he literally felt love pouring from the eyes and face of the saint. He just felt flooded with it, all of it says. So he didn't need to ask anything further. In other words, he was looked at. The saint probably saw him with the lovely love mind, and saw his beauty through love, wishing him to have that beauty. He felt like he was really delighted to see that a yogi in another tradition, without necessarily the Buddhist teaching, could achieve such a powerful field of love. He was very, very pleased about it. He often tells the story in the context of overcoming religious sectarianism and divisiveness, that all of the spiritual traditions have reached some of the same points if people really put them into practice. And that also felt encouraged in his basic theory that he shares with all fellow co-religionists of not to try to convert each other, to teach good methodologies that they have developed in their different traditions if the other is interested, but not seek to make them shift denomination to use that in their thing, like convert them. That's not necessary for the idea. So and in order to get them to think about that, those who feel that part of their thing is to convert others and try to brainwash them to shift their tradition, something wrong with where they are, he talks about how he used to think others who didn't have this and that teaching couldn't get there type of thing. And he has been disillusioned about that and overcome that by meeting really holy people from all the traditions. The work of bringing benefit to beings will not then make me proud and self-admiring. The happiness of others is itself my satisfaction. I do not expect another recompense, he says. Therefore, just as I defend myself from even slight disparagement, in just the same way with regard to others, I should likewise have a mind protective and compassionate. And then this is quite fun, I think. This is a little bit deep. 111. The drop of sperm and blood belonging to others, yet through strong habituation, belongs to others rather, Yet through strong habituation, I came to have in its regard a sense of I. I don't know, in its regard? I don't know about that. I came to have, what did I say? This is better. Through the power of familiarization, I have come to regard as myself, quote unquote, a few drops of other sperm and ovum, in themselves quite insubstantial. I think that's better. Because I came to have in its regard a sense of I. In regard to it, in its regard, I don't like that expression. Though in itself it is devoid of entity, oh my. What does that mean? It is devoid of entity? Is that very meaningful for you? I don't think so. It has no intrinsic identity, is what it means. You know, but it's not only that. You know, if you see a condom on the ground or something, you know, you're not really attracted to drops of sperm and ovum, basically. You know, it's something alien. Yeah. And so one has come to identify what has built up out of those genes, this body. This is me, you know. Although in itself it's insubstantial, or it is lacks substance, or it lacks intrinsic reality. And so why not identify another's body? Another's body. Call it my I, quote unquote. And vice versa. Why should it be hard to think of this my body as another's? Perceiving now the faults possessed by, quote, I, unquote, the ocean of good qualities that are in, quote, other, unquote, I should lay aside all love of self and gain the habit of adopting other beings. Having understood the flaws, I prefer mine. Strangely enough. Not always. Sometimes I think I didn't do it well because I redid it from the original. But having understood the flaws in self-concern, it's not the flaws of the pronoun I. Something wrong with the pronoun I doesn't have flaws. It's just a pronoun. So rather, having understood the flaws in self-concern, you know, or in my nowadays I might say self-preoccupation, and the ocean of advantages in other concern or altruism, I must abandon all self-preoccupation and cultivate concern for others. This is a very important verse, because that's what you're exchanging. Actually, in the equal exchange of self and other, sometimes people write it self-concern and other concern. So you switch your habitual self-concern for a habitual altruism or other concern. So you expand your field of attention to think of how whatever it is affects others and how what you do affects them. And that becomes like a habit. You shift that habit. Just like you have a habit, I have a habit. I get up, what should I do today? What am I going to get out of today for myself? Oh, will this be good? Will that be bad? Will this be good enough? Will that be bad enough to avoid? Etc. We have this self-concern. We think that's normal and inevitable. And they're saying that actually the more we can switch that, exchange that for other concern, like what are others going to get out of today? What can I do for them that has all the advantages, and that's a better habit. And actually, then there's that famous thing that makes us actually happier, actually. Because when we think about what we're going to get out of it, one thing we know for sure by experience is you're not going to get enough out of it. It's not going to be satisfying. See, you can't get no satisfaction, right? Because you're just looking at how much satisfaction you have, so therefore it won't be enough. So why not just forget about it ahead of time? And then others, of course it won't be enough either, but at least they'll be, you know, you're distracted from feeling dissatisfied about what you have. Anyway, just as the hand and so on are accepted as inalienable limbs of the body, why should not embodied beings be accepted as inalienable limbs of life? So everyone should be my body type of, because that's what how a Buddha feels, actually. So one is imitating, in a way, imaginatively, the actual experience of an enlightened being who has become non-dual in regard to self and other. Just as habit. Well, somebody corrected my custom. Habit, they put. That's good. I agree with you, whoever wrote that. I have this book. Someone else made notes in my book. Just as habit creates a sense of self. Oh, wait, back to here. Just as hands and other limbs are thought of as the members of a body, can we likewise not consider others as the limbs and members of a living whole? Okay. Just as in connection with this form, devoid of self, my sense of I arose through strong habituation, why should not the thought of I through habit not arise related to another? Sure, why not? That's not bad. Thus, when I work for others' sake, there'll be no sense of boasting self-congratulations. It is just as when I feed myself, I don't expect to be rewarded. Correct. It's like you just deal with others' suffering because it's suffering, not whether it's yours or theirs. Just as I defend myself from even slight disparagement, oh, repeating the other line, but I think it does repeat the other line. Likewise, for beings, I shall now grow used to have a mind protective and compassionate. This is why the Lord Avalokita, out of great compassion, blessed his name, that those caught in the midst of multitudes might be released and freed from every fear. Yeah, you know, the name Avalokiteshvara, Avalokiteshvara, itself is a criticism of the Vedist name for the Vedist slash Hindu, now coming later, Hindu name for the creator God, which was Maheshvara. Ishvara means God, and Maha means great. So, you know, the omnipotent great God, you know, the big boss. And Avalokita means who looks down with loving concern. So, in other words, it's a shift. That name itself is a critique of the idea of the fearsome God, you know, the one, the fear of God, into a God that cares for you. And I think Tambaya doesn't pick on that because he doesn't know Mahayana. And remember I told you to read Tambaya about Ashoka, called World Conqueror and World Renouncer. And he writes about how, due to Ashoka, he feels, or the model of Ashoka, the norm of Indian kingship changed in that third century before the Common Era, from the king has absolute divine authority, can kill anyone righteously and so forth, because the king is the arms of the omnipotent God, to the king is the parent of the people and looks with loving concern like a mother or a father. In the case of Ashoka, he mentioned father rather than mother, the father of every being, so that the idea of like the all-benevolent, all-compassionate king. And Tambaya, because he doesn't read Mahayana sources, he didn't before he wrote that book, the Avalokiteshvara concept arising of the Bodhisattva around the time of Ashoka, actually 400 years after Buddha's time, before the CE centuries, there was even a critique of the idea of God, and that sort of goes with the sociological or materialist analysis that the image of a God in a culture will very much support and relate to the image of the royal authority. They'll be very interconnected. So you fear that the king rules by fear. Oh, you're afraid of the gods. King rules by love, supposedly, some sort of paternalistic image about a king. And then it's not that they have divine right. It's that they're there to care. They're there to care for you. And of course, we in America cannot imagine the concept in a culture of a king who really cares for you. But the Asian experience is different, because the Asian experience is that when robber barons are powerful and there's a weak center in a society, the people are more oppressed than when there is someone who has, like in Chinese history, the cycle of dynasties. The beginnings of a dynasty are usually better for a people. Well, the very beginning isn't very good because the previous dynasty has become very decayed and decadent, and there's been a tremendous amount of conflict of people vying for the supreme power, the robber barons, so to speak. And so the first very beginning is very rough, and everything is sort of unified in a rough way. And then, like, the Qin Empire is like that. The first, the Qin guy, he was very ferociously nasty to everybody. But then that never lasts, and then that sort of, once things are unified, then a more paternalistic and benevolent idea of kingship emerges. And then that kingship keeps the robber baron people down, and then the individual peasant, the individual, the people, get a better deal. And that is their history. Whereas we just have, because of America, Thomas Paine, you know, and King George was nuts by hand, right, that King George was. Somehow Georges have always been cracked. I don't know why. We've had a lot of them lately around here. And I don't know what it is about that name. And So therefore, we think all kings are necessarily really bad. And of course, a bad king is the worst. But the good king, really truly good king, is the best, actually. So whatever. So cultivate concern for others. So there we are. Now, living. Where are we now? Oh yeah, I skipped the page. Oh, this is why Lord Avalokita, out of great compassion, blessed his name. So the Ishvara, the God name, but this is the one who looks out for me, the Avalokita means. The God who looks out for me, rather than the God who is just greater than me. That's the big shift. So we should be understood, undeterred by hardships, for through the influence of use and habit, people even come to grieve for those whose very names struck terror in their hearts. Those desiring, I don't know about that one. I should not shrink from what is hard, for such habituation is so powerful. I don't think they got that. Okay, that's correct. I should not shrink from what is hard. We should not be undeterred by hardships. We should be undeterred, yet we should not shrink from. Okay. For through the influence of use and habit, for such habituation is so powerful, fear at the mention of a person's name can create displeasure even when they're absent. I don't think people can come to grieve for those whose very names. No. That's, I think mine is correct. Anyway, that's one that we both have to reflect about. But I don't have a pen. One who desires as soon as possible to give refuge to self and others should practice the holy secret teaching of the transposition of self and other. Those desiring speedily to be refuge for themselves and others should make the interchange of I and other and thus embrace a sacred mystery. I like mine. In that case. No, I'm trying to be fair. You know? Interchange. I don't know. Easy pass. Because of our attachment to our bodies, even little things alarm us. This body then is the source of so much terror. Why, who would not detest it as the worst of foes? Wishing to relieve our body's ills, our hungry mouths, the dryness of our throats, we steal the lives of fishes, birds, and deer, and lie in wait along the road. And for the sake of profit and position, some there are who even kill their parents or steal what has been offered to the triple gem, because of which they'll burn in hell of unrelenting pain. Yeah, those are what are called the unrelented sins. Yeah. Where are the wise and prudent then who cherish, guard, and serve the body? Who would not perceive it as their foe and as their foe regarded with contempt? If I give this, what will be left for me? Thinking of oneself, the way of evil ghosts. If I keep this, what will be left to give? Concern for others is the way of heaven. If to serve myself I harm another, I'll suffer later in the realms of hell. And if for others' sake I harm myself, then every excellence will be my heritage. Wanting what is best for me, stupidity, inferiority, and lower realms result. Let this be changed, applied to others, honors and the realms of bliss will come. Enslaving others, forcing them to serve me, I will come to know the state of servitude. But if I labor for the good of others, mastery and leadership will come to me. And then this is the really key, very famous verse. All the joy the world contains, this I call the Shantideva challenge. All the joy the world contains has come through wishing happiness for others. All the misery the world contains has come through wanting pleasure for myself. And mine is just pretty much the same. All happiness in the world arises from the wish for others' happiness. All suffering in this world arises from the wish for one's own happiness. And here, does anybody want to argue this point? Like, I got happy because I wanted my own happiness. You want to argue that? I sometimes do debate that with people. I don't really have too much time. But, of course, you have to understand that even the human body that you have came from your having been another kind of mammal, a less well-endowed, a less developed, less intelligent, less liberated animal, from wanting the happiness of others. Became a mammal from that, and from being a predatory mammal or a lesser mammal, you became the human mammal. By that, some degree of altruism, some degree of empathy. You know, Shantideva is presuming in his audience that they know that the karmic or evolutionary fruit of altruism and morality, because morality is altruism, fruit of altruism is humanity. Humanity comes from being altruistic as other animals. Yes?
But if you understand that, then your focus becomes helping others so that you can feel happy.
That's okay. Enlightened self-interest is fine. That's okay. But, of course, if you have no wish to help them, and you're doing it for yourself, then it's not enlightened self-interest, it's just self-interest.
Yes.
So it has to be split. In other words, for it to really work, you have to be really focused, and your motivation has to be the happiness of the other, and then you will get happy. If your motivation is your own happiness primarily, then it's not enlightened self-interest, it's unenlightened self-interest. Then it won't have the effect. So the paradox protects itself, let's say.
Yeah.
Let's say, yes.
Also, the seven steps suggest that it's sort of...
What?
The seven steps that you outlined suggest that it's sort of it's compulsive. Once reaching the certain understandings, you are so moved.
Oh, yeah, well, that's in the sevenfold one. Actually, there's a way, too, of combining the two, where you bring at the lovely love and around in here, you sort of bring in the exchange of self and other before you do the universal responsibility. So that's considered more powerful. In fact, if you combine the two, there's a way in which Tsongkhapa, later we'll see in Tibet, he does that. Anyway, this is and then that's sort of sealed for Shantideva, where he says, what need to say a great deal more, or is there need for a lengthy explanation? Childish beings look out for themselves. Buddhas labor for the good of others. See the difference that divides them. Or what need to say a great deal more? The immature work for their own sake. Buddhas work for the sake of others. Just look at the difference between them. So, but anyway, doesn't anybody want to take up the Shantideva challenge? How you really wanted yourself to be happy, and then you were really happy. I have debated this. You guys are very peaceful. Sometimes I have very contentious classes, and somebody argues, and usually some male will finally argue. Here you go. 140. Take others, lower, higher, equal, as yourself. Identify yourself as other. Then, without another thought, immerse yourself in envy, pride, and rivalry. Not bad. I say, taking inferior, equal, and superior beings as myself, and taking myself to be another, with my mind free of conceptual thoughts, I should cultivate pride, competitiveness, and envy. So this is the thing. It's very realistic, Shantideva, this practice is. And that is where when we meet each other, people have a tendency, sort of, it's a reflex that we have. We measure the person we meet. It's like dogs sniffing each other, you know, when they meet. And if they don't attack each other instantly, if one of them is not super neurotic, but otherwise they usually sort of sniff around. So we do too. And then we sort of, the reason we do it is a kind of instinctive, paranoid thing. Is this person my equal? Are they somehow my better? Or are they my inferior? We want to kind of figure out how to locate them. And then, without necessarily being a bad person, our mind adapts. And automatically, if we feel they're my better, I feel jealous or envious. If they're my equal, I want to see if I can find an advantage. I want to compete. I want to rival them. If I feel they're sort of lesser than me, I feel condescension to them. Maybe we don't have to go all the way to contempt, but condescension. So if this is sort of a basic human thing, Shantideva is saying, then when you meet someone, when you're practicing the equal exchange of self and other, what you do is you note whatever comes up for you, and then you flip it and look at yourself from the perspective of the other. And so if you feel a little higher and condescending, although you might be a really nice person, you're not going to behave condescendingly, you think. You know, I'm Mr. Equal, I'm democratic American, everybody's my buddy. but actually maybe something condescending about the way you are, maybe tone of voice, maybe attitude, you know, whatever. Germans have a great expression for being arrogant. They call it hochnäsig, high nose. I mean, your posture, your body language gives it away. And so you look at them, then if you feel that way, oh, this is somebody a little lesser, then you look at yourself from their perspective and see if they might be thinking enviously about you in some way, which means looking for your faults. And then if you feel pretty equal, that they're neck and neck with you, you then look at yourself as a competitor might, looking for also a weak point, some place to gain advantage. And if you're looking at yourself, if you look at them kind of looking up at them in some way, the president, comes in, Mr. Clinton, something like, oh yeah, fills the room, people say, this kind of thing. And then you're looking like that. But then why do Americans take such joy in the downfall of the movie star? You know? It's the envy is there, you see, of that person. So then you look at yourself condescendingly. And when you do that practice, you become at first a bit self-conscious because you see your mannerisms and how they reflect your sort of basic instinctual feeling in encountering other people and regarding them. And you work hard to undo that because you're seeing how they are affected by what, because you look at yourself through their eyes and then they give you a clue, like you will be like this or like that. And that's what they irritate them, makes them jealous or makes them competitive or makes them condescending to you. So it's a really powerful thing. And when they say immerse yourself in it, that is really deal with human nature and then develop the sense of how it is in interacting with others that you can actually make them cheer them up. What is it that it takes to cheer them up? You become much more sensitive to that. And it's a very deep thing. It's quite difficult. And people never explain it. And they worry about it. And how does he go on with it? He is the center of attention. I am nothing. And unlike him, I'm poor without possessions. Everyone looks up to him, despising me. All goes well for him. For me, there's only bitterness. All I have now, he's really doing the envy one. All I have is sweat and drudgery while he's there sitting at his ease. He's great, respected in the world, while I'm the underdog, a well-known nobody. What? A nobody without distinction? Not true. I do have some good qualities. Compared with some, he's lower down. Compared with some, I do excel. My discipline, my understanding have declined, but I am helpless, ruled by my defilements. As much as he is able, he should cure me. I will be submissive even to his punishment. So anyway, there he lives out in his mind different ways others will look at him. And I don't need to really deal with it. In fact, I can't. We finished. So anyway, okay, take it easy.